I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today for our last presentation for this year. Our speaker today, Dennis O'Rourke, is a bit of an expert on fleet aero activities, but more particularly activities in the air. Dennis has presented to us several times over the last couple of years, and it's always great to get that aerial or that air presentation in. So without further ado, I'll ask Dennis to commence his presentation, and we'll have time for questions afterwards. So welcome, Dennis.
I must admit that I'm somewhat nervous about this presentation today, given that our friends from Ohakia have arrived, and I suggest they know an awful lot more about bombing than I do, but I'll give it my best shot. Just as a bit of a warning, there are a couple of images in this presentation which some people may find disturbing. Okay, there's a belief that the bombing war planning by the Americans air forces in World War II only began as a consequence of the Japanese Navy's attack on Pearl Harbor. This is not so. The American war planners had, for quite some time, considered that a conflict with Japan was very likely. Though it was considered that it would be primarily a naval war, there was a belief in American military aviation community that the Japanese cities were very vulnerable to bombing and that they were very susceptible to fire because of the light nature of the building materials used for housing. The Imperial Japanese Navy's attack on Pearl Harbor on the 6th of December 1941 heralded the start of the overt conflict between the Western Allies and the forces of Imperial Japan, which consumed the Asia-Pacific region for the next 4 years or so. But bearing in mind, too, that the Japanese had been fighting in China for some years before then. I think that the Chinese incident started in about 1936. There had always been a plan to initiate the bombing of Japanese Asian bases, but the Japanese preemptive strikes and the speed of the Japanese advance very quickly negated any possibility of that happening, with the Allied aircraft and the Allied bases that were then available. On day one, Malaya was attacked, and the RAF, RAAF and RNZAF were fully committed to opposing the rapidly advancing Japanese forces with aircraft that were generally unsuited for the task, and they were quite quickly overwhelmed, though they did put up a good fight. Also on day one, the American bombing forces based in the Philippines were attacked and largely destroyed as a consequence of American command hesitancy and poor response. The few bombers that were left were forced to move to secondary airfields and eventually via the Indonesian islands to Australia. As a result, there were no Allied aircraft, given the long ranges required, that were capable of reaching the Japanese bases and retaliating on the attacks on the American bases in the Philippines by the forces of Imperial Japan. After the initial Japanese victories in the Pacific, a raid consisting of medium bombers carried to Japanese waters by a United States Navy task force was suggested. This was approved by President Roosevelt, and the operation was headed by Colonel James Doolittle. Doolittle was a famous American aviator who'd been called back to service in the United States Army Air Force. It was found possible to do so by using B-25 Mitchell bombers, and 16 of these aircraft were loaded aboard the United States carrier USS Hornet, and the task force sortied towards Japan in April 1942. J. Jimmy Doolittle had been an early US military aviator but had left the Army Air Corps for civilian employment, and he was a renowned air race pilot and aircraft demonstrator. At the start of the war, he was recalled to the colours and ended the war as a Lieutenant General commanding the huge 8th Air Force based in Great Britain. Tied to the fuse of one of the bombs that was carried in his aircraft on this raid was a Japanese medal that he'd been awarded prior to the outbreak of war. So I think that was pretty good propaganda. They made great play of that. The task force was sighted by Japanese patrolling boats before reaching the planned launch position, and that caused a decision by the US Navy to launch early in the knowledge that the aircraft would not be able to reach the American airfields in China. The aircraft successfully attacked Japanese targets but caused little real damage. However, it was a huge morale boost for the American people, and it was a wake-up call for the Japanese home islands. The aircraft flew on towards China until their fuel ran out and the air crews bailed out. Most of the air crew survived, though a few were captured by the Japanese, and several of these were executed by them. One of the aircraft flew north to Russia and the crew was interned. The main focus of the later bombing of the Japanese mainland was centred around the Boeing B-29 Super Fortress. This was a hugely cutting-edge aircraft design and a production program which cost an extraordinary amount of money. It was one of the largest aircraft in World War II, with state-of-the-art technology, including a pressurized cabin, tricycle landing gear, and an analog computer-controlled fire control system. The program cost $3 billion, which is equivalent to about $43 billion in today's money, and it exceeded the $1.9 billion cost of the atomic bomb program, making the Super Fortress program the most expensive production program of World War II. Such was the demand for the aircraft as it was initially built. While there were numerous technical and design issues being dealt with at the same time that the aircraft was being produced in quantity, it was necessary to set up depots to modify the aircraft before it was deemed capable of being used in combat. Notwithstanding that, it was being issued to United States Army Air Force very heavy bomb groups at the time. This remediation progress was nicknamed the Battle of Kansas. A particular issue was the tendency for the new R-3350 engines, which were constantly overheating and as a consequence catching fire. This was a problem that continued to dog the aircraft when it finally took part in the Pacific War. General Hap Arnold commanded the US Army Air Forces throughout World War II. Spatz was the senior airman in the European theatre, and Eaker initially commanded the 8th Air Force in Britain and then the air forces in the Mediterranean theatre. Spatz was the designated air commander for the proposed invasion of Japan at the end of 1945. Brigadier General Hansel was the initial commander of the Super Fortress wings, but was relieved by LeMay as a consequence of the initial failure of the Japanese bombing campaign. Rosie O'Donnell was the commander of the first fire raid on Tokyo, and he flew on that raid. While I call these men bomber barons, is that they were all true believers, together with Arthur Bomber Harris of the Royal Air Force, in the belief that bombing, and particularly precision bombing, could win the war to the exclusion of all the other arms, the Navy and boots-on-the-ground soldiers. The American airmen were wedded to the Norden bombsight, which they claimed let them drop a bomb into a pickle barrel from 30,000 feet. It's good PR, but it's a claim that took no account of weather or enemy action, to say the very least. The initial deployment of the Super Fortress squadrons, commanded by Curtis LeMay, whom we'll meet again later, was to airfields in the vicinity of Calcutta in India, with a view to their being based on forward airfields in China, within range of the Japanese home islands. This was a hugely logistic leap of faith. The forward airfields had to be built by hand by Japanese labour. All of the fuel and all of the bombs had to be flown over the Himalayas by air, from India by air. And this was a mighty endeavour which cost the lives of many hundreds of airmen and their aircraft. It even involved B-29 Super Fortresses being used as aerial tankers to carry fuel to the Chinese airfields. As well as the appalling weather and the terrain, the air crews had to contend with attacks by Japanese fighters in northern Burma. Converted Liberator bombers were used as freighters and tankers, as well as C-46 commando freighters, and as previously stated, Super Fortresses. In all, during the course of the operation, a total of 373 United States Army Air Force aircraft were lost, and 1,314 airmen and passengers were killed. It was said that you could navigate over the hump by following the sights of the crashed aircraft. I've read that the effort used up 12 gallons of aviation fuel to deliver 1 gallon to the Chinese airfields. The air movement over the hump between India and China attained a peak rate of 71,000 tonnes a month, which is quite startling, really, given the capabilities of the aircraft at the time. The United States commissioned airfields in China, which were constructed using masses of Chinese men, women and children power with very little machinery. Effectively, these airfields were built by hand using baskets, wheelbarrows and man-hauled rollers. After an initial raid on Thai targets, the bombers transited to their Chinese forward bases on June 1944, flying the first raid on the Japanese home islands, which was not very successful, as were a number of further raids. These raids were flown at high level and the polar jet stream was encountered for the first time. Flying into the jet stream caused aircraft to speed over the target at anything up to 500 miles an hour, or flying into the jet stream, their speed could be reduced to as little as 50 miles per hour, which of course the aircraft's northern bomb sites couldn't handle the speeds, and flying over the target at 50 miles an hour is a real gift to anti-aircraft gunners. Now, of course, modern jet airliners use the jet stream to their advantage. But though the existence of the jet stream was known before the war, its effect on bombing had not been considered, and very few aircraft before the Super Fortress could fly high enough to be affected by it. Another problem which acted against targeted bombing and it continued throughout the war was the Japanese winter weather, which was very, very cloudy. These problems continued until the B-29 raids were flown at low level and at night from the bases on the Marianas Islands in 1945. In the first instance, the Super Fortress raids were aimed at specific industrial targets and not the area bombing of Japanese cities. It was finally decided, because of the almost impossible logistic issues and the fact that the Chinese forward airfields did not give the Super Fortresses sufficient range to cover all of the Japanese home islands, the aircraft were to be based on the recently conquered Marianas Islands, which had in fact been the long-term plan for the operation, particularly the islands of Guam, Saipan and Tinian. These islands were invaded at great cost and casualties in mid-1944, and huge airfields were constructed by the Americans on which the superfortresses were to be based to bring them within range of the home islands of Japan. This is a photograph of just one of the Marianas Island airfields showing the huge numbers of B-29 superfortresses based on this one particular airfield. There were a number of these airfields on Guam, Saipan and Tinian. I defy you to count them all, but that's an awful lot of aeroplanes. This photograph of another of the airfields shows the three runways as well as the numerous aircraft parks and taxiways. It was a tremendous engineering undertaking involving a huge logistic operation and thousands of construction personnel. It should be noted that almost all of the material necessary to construct these airfields and their infrastructure, as well as the fuel and bombs carried by the aircraft, had to be transported from the mainland United States. Isley Field, which I showed you on the previous slide, was a sugarcane field before it was converted into a huge airfield. Added to the human cost of invading the Marianas in the face of ferocious Japanese resistance, it was thought necessary to invade the island of Iwo Jima, which was about halfway along the superfortress's flight path to Japan. The first superfortress to make an emergency landing did so while the battle to secure the island was still being fought. In all, 2,251 B-29 landings on Iwo Jima were recorded during the war. So you can think of how many people, how many aircrew that the fact that they could land on Iwo Jima saved. Iwo Jima was also used as a base for medium bombers and also long-range P-51 Mustang fighters, which eventually escorted the superfortresses on their daylight raids to Japan, as were the airfields on Okinawa, which was again conquered at very significant American casualties. If you go to Mr. Google, you can find some great clips, video clips of superfortresses landing and crashing on Iwo Jima. When the superfortresses were transferred from China and India, and further aircraft arrived from mainland America, General Hansel took over what became the 20th Air Force. High-level precision raids were undertaken, which were no more successful than earlier. The commanding general of the United States Army Air Forces, General Arnold, lost patience with Possum Hansel and replaced him with Curtis LeMay. Possum Hansel was a devotee of precision bombing. Initially, so was Curtis LeMay, but that changed. LeMay was a successful bomber commander from the 8th Air Force in the United Kingdom. He initially continued with the daylight high-level raids until deciding that they were not achieving any useful results. The 20th Air Force was unusual in that it was controlled directly by Air Force headquarters in Washington and not commanded by either Admiral Nimitz or General MacArthur, who commanded the United States forces in the Pacific Theater. This is a photograph of a superfortress on a raid over Japan. Note the oil streaming from the starboard inner engine, and as previously said, this was a continuing problem with these aircraft. I'd suggest that on the way home he'd have gone to Iwo Jima. The Dugway Proving Ground in Utah on the mainland United States was a high security testing facility for chemical and biological weapons. The purpose of the replicas of Japanese homes which were repeatedly rebuilt after being intentionally burned down, was to perfect the use of the incendiary bombing tactics used in the subsequent firebombing of Japanese cities during World War II. It was designed by an American architect who had worked in Japan for a number of years. The most successful bomb to come out of the May to September 1943 tests against the mock-up Japanese homes at the Dugway Proving Ground was the napalm-filled M69 incendiary cluster bomb. 38 of these napalm-filled bombs were contained within a 500-pound M19 cluster bomb. A B-29 could carry up to 20,000 pounds of bombs over short distances at low altitude. A more common bomb load was 12,000 pounds at long range and medium altitude. Napalm was developed by American scientists at Harvard University and was initially tested on the university's playing fields. This photograph shows hundreds of these napalm-filled cluster bombs being released by superfortresses over a Japanese target. I had to add this into the presentation because I think it's beautiful artwork and it shows the bombers heading for Japan in the evening light. Trying to keep out of each other's way, I would think. In a dramatic change of tactics, Curtis LeMay directed the bombers' attack at night and at low altitudes. He also directed that the aircraft guns were to be removed and the gunners left out of the cruise with the exception of the tail gunner. This was generally viewed by the airmen taking part as suicide tactics, but because of the poor radar coverage and the dearth of suitable night fighters by the Japanese defences, and the lack of sufficient anti-aircraft artillery, the tactics employed by the Americans were far more successful than was anticipated, though bombers would still be lost. Apparently, something like 1,400 B-29 superfortresses were lost in the operations against Japan. That's an awful lot of aeroplanes. On the night of the 9th, 10th of March 1945, the first low-level night fire raid took place over Tokyo. It's estimated, and there are anything between 30,000 and 200,000 in various publications, but it's estimated that up to 100,000 people died and up to 1 million people were injured in this raid. Nearly 300,000 buildings were destroyed and up to another 1 million people were made homeless. You can see the extent of the devastation there from the napalm attacks on the Japanese housing. This photograph shows a pile of charred corpses after the raid. By far the majority of persons killed and injured in this and other raids were civilians, men, women and children. These charts show the burned out areas of major target cities as a consequence of these bombing raids. They burned the heart out of urban Japan in a very short few months. This is another illustration of the extent of damage caused by the American bombing of the Japanese towns and cities. Towards the end of the campaign, the 20th Air Force was running out of large urban targets and was starting to raid smaller cities and even towns. This was combined with the assault on Japan by the carrier air fleets of the US Navy and the fleet air arm of the Royal Navy, as well as bombers and escorting fighters based in Iwo Jima and Okinawa. The bombing casualties resulting in the first fire raid on Tokyo were not repeated in a number of the other cities which were attacked. The US Strategic Bombing Survey, made at the end of hostilities, estimated that, including the two atomic bombing raids on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these resulted in an estimated total of 806,000 casualties, including the deaths of 330,000 people. This figure would not, of course, include the radiation sickness fatalities over the coming years in respect of the raids on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The United States Navy Fast Carrier Force, together with the Royal Navy's Pacific Fleet, were also conducting raids on Japanese mainland infrastructure in preparation for the invasion, which was scheduled for November 1945. Each of the large American carriers carried something in the order of 100 aircraft each, and the British carriers somewhat less. The targets for the Navy's air attacks were primarily shipping and airfields in preparation for the invasion. This is a very, I think, well-named operation, Operation Starvation. The 20th Air Force flew a total of 1,529 sorties to lay 12,135 mines in US minefields on missions during the bombing campaign. Mining demanded only 5.7% of the Bomber Command's total sorties, and only 15 B-29s were lost in the effort. In return, mines sank or damaged 670 ships, totaling more than 1.25 million tons. This mining campaign proved the most efficient means of destroying Japanese shipping during World War II. In terms of damage per unit of cost, it surpassed both strategic bombing and the United States submarine campaign. The loss of the captured territories and the American submarine campaign, together with Operation Starvation, severely curtailed food and oil imports into mainland Japan. And by the time the bombing campaign commenced, the lack of nutrition was causing huge problems with the feeding of the population and was causing a significant drop in civilian morale. Operation Downfall was the planned Allied invasion of the Japanese home islands. The first operation was Operation Olympic, the invasion of the southern island of Kyushu, which was scheduled for November 1945, and in early 1946, Operation Coronet was planned, which was the invasion of the Kanto Plain on the main Japanese island of Honshu. Operation Olympic was to be an all-American affair, but Operation Coronet was planned to include British and Commonwealth forces. When we talk about, later on, talk about the atomic bombing of Japan, you've got to bear these figures in mind. The Japanese at that time were harboring, were keeping their aircraft as safe as they possibly could, waiting for the expected invasion. In Kyushu, the southern island, there were 900,000 Japanese soldiers. Estimated Allied casualties were anything up to 1 million killed and wounded. And the Americans actually ordered 500,000 Purple Heart medals to cover the expected losses. It's rather interesting to note that the American services are still issuing those Purple Hearts. They haven't run out yet. And again, the Japanese had ordered the execution of something in the order of 100,000 Allied prisoners of war held in mainland Japan in the event of the invasion of the home islands. So you've got to bear that in mind when you're thinking about the results of the bombing campaign, and was it necessary to use atomic bombs. This is perhaps where the subject gets very controversial, but I don't believe that it was particularly controversial at the time, but it has certainly done so in the years that have gone by. I think in August 1945, when the World War II ended, that people were more, they were happy that the war had ended rather than worrying about people getting bombs dropped on them. The US atomic bomb project, assisted by Great Britain, the Manhattan Project, commenced in 1939, which was well before the United States became an active combatant in the Second World War. For our purposes, it culminated with the trial detonation of an atomic bomb device in the New Mexico desert on the 16th of July 1945. It is interesting to note that though it was a huge project and was so secret that when Harry Truman became the US president on the death of Franklin Roosevelt, he did not know of the existence of the program, even though he was the vice president of the United States. I think that was probably taking me to know just a little too far. The 509th Composite Bomb Group were nominated to drop the bombs as required and were activated on the 17th of December 1944, and they arrived in Tinian in July of 1945 and operated out of a special area on North Field. This is the crew of the B-29 Enola Gay with the commander Paul Tibbetts in the middle, who dropped the Hiroshima bomb. They accompanied another B-29 boxcar when it dropped the Nagasaki bomb a few days later. It's interesting to note that Admirals King and Nimitz and some in the United States Army Air Force believed that the ongoing bombing campaign, as well as the mining and submarine operations, would bring Japan to its knees and that an invasion would not be necessary. The decision to drop the bombs was made by President Truman. There are a lot of conflicting arguments in respect of whether or not it was necessary to drop the bombs. The final decision, as I said, to drop them was made by President Truman. He was of the view that the Allied casualties in an invasion would be huge and dropping the bombs would stop the war. By that time, a group in the Japanese government was seeking dialogue to end the war through via Moscow. The Japanese military was adamant that the fight should be continued to the end, and they were in the process of mobilizing the population to fight with them. Balance the casualties of the atomic bombs against what would have been the huge, huge casualties, both military and civilian, if a land invasion had been necessary. Did the dropping of the atomic bombs cause the surrender of Japan? There were a number of factors involved, and one of the major factors was the unexpected Soviet invasion of Manchuria and the destruction of the major Japanese military forces stationed there. And you have to bear in mind, when thinking about the decision to drop the bombs, the view of the Japanese military to go down fighting. This is an amended quote from a book on the military history of the American Civil War, which was a few days before then, in a chapter which discusses the nature of war as a life and death struggle for survival between nations. And I think it's appropriate in respect of the subject I've discussed this afternoon. Thank you. Wow.
Great, thank you very much, Dennis. Very interesting and somewhat controversial topic. We've got plenty of time for questions and comments, so fire away.
you've got that interesting bit of paper.
Oh, see this.
This bit of paper is headed World War 11. Theodore Dutch J. Van Kirk, who was the navigator on the Enola Gay when it dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, he is the last surviving member of the crew. And apparently this really happened. He was asked to speak at a grammar school recently. The young teacher introduced him by saying the speaker was a veteran of World War 11. Dutch stood up and walked out of the school without saying a word. I can understand that.
Read the bottom two words.
For those who understand, no explanation is needed. For those who do not understand, no explanation is possible.
A few years ago, I visited the Hitachi factory in Hitachi City, north of Tokyo. That was bombed. I think they even made electric boats for Japanese submarines or something there during the Second World War. They didn't actually say. But they have a museum of the history of Hitachi, including a map of the bombing during the Second World War. I think it was bombed from an aircraft carrier, borne aircraft, but the Japanese, in their typical thoroughness, plotted the location of every bomb explosion crater over a map of the plant and city. And I was really impressed by, if you'd drawn a grid, you would be able to basically draw a grid on the lines. So the pattern bombing they did and the evenness of the bombing, so they got destruction, the maximum destruction with the minimum effort was quite impressive, actually. If you wanted to add it to your research, you may be able to write to the museum, Hitachi Museum, and get a copy of it, because it's a very interesting document.
The American bombing got a lot more accurate after the night firebomb raids on the city, where because of the suppression of the Japanese air defences, the B-29s were flying daylight raids at medium level, and the Norden bomb site was working a lot better then.
Other comments, questions?
That photo you had of all those planes parked beside the runway.
Yeah.
That's an amazing photo,
Oh, it is, considering that probably 6 months before they were just sugarcane fields.
Yeah.
And the surrounding areas as well, because they also had hard stands, hard pads, and taxiways and other infrastructure there.
Oh, it's huge.
Incredible.
Accommodation, etc., etc. And most of that stuff had to come from mainland United States. So, it's a huge, huge logistic operation, the whole thing.
It's also a very good, you mentioned YouTube videos, is a very good YouTube video of the production of the Super Fortress planes and the aircraft production in the United States, and it's just amazing the speed with which they built it up and how they mobilised everything and built these factories and barriers to crank out all these planes. I recommend it.
And cranked out thousands and thousands of aircrew who are all, in my view, children. A lot of the aircraft commanders were flying second tours, who had finished a tour on, say, B-17s or Liberators in Europe, and then came home for a break, and then were posted to B-29 squadrons, including the crew of Memphis Belle.
To get an idea of scale, if you go to any of the Boeing factories of today, which were the original, some of the original production factories, I went to one in Renton Field in Tacoma, just south of, north of
Seattle,
and it was just amazing. They were turning out aircraft, in today's terms, but you could see the layout of their production lines. from when they were pushing stuff out during World War II. It was just unbelievable. You know, they had something like their weekly delivery was rolling, I think it was 3 777s and so many 757s. And, you know, it was just, yeah, amazing. But you can see the scale of what they produced for this operation or these operations. Any comments from our Air Force colleagues?
No, I was just going to say thanks, that's absolutely fascinating. But you said towards the end that they're flying medium level in daylight. Can you give us an idea of what sort of opposition the atomic bombing raid faced, was, if any?
What opposition was to the bombing?
As in physical opposition from the Japanese. Were there any forces left to oppose them?
The Japanese had still a fighter force, but sadly, most of their very good pilots and their experienced pilots had been killed earlier in the Pacific War, so that there were a cadre of very good and very experienced Japanese fighter pilots, and the great bulk of them were, like the Luftwaffe at the end of the war, not experienced enough to survive.
So there was very little opposition.
Oh, I mean, as I said, they lost 400 and something super fortresses, and they would have lost other bombers coming in from Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and the fighters, of course. You know, so, people were still getting killed.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, we've now got a flurry. Yes.
Dennis, the occupation of Japan at the end of the war, especially by New Zealanders and the DC-3s, I guess, from C-47s in those days, were going to and from Japan. What do you know? What sort of area of Japan, which island were they based, or were they spread out to bring people to and from?
It was mostly around Kure and Hiroshima, the New Zealand forces.
Yeah.
And I think the Corsair fighter squadron that was based up there was just out of Kure.
Thank you.
Rebecca, yeah.
I think my question may have been answered.
So oh, okay.
The role of New Zealanders in Japan.
Well, there were quite a few New Zealanders in the British Pacific Fleet. We had two cruisers and a number of smaller vessels. And there were something, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but there was a very high percentage of New Zealand air crew in the fleet air arm in the Pacific at that stage.
Any other? Yeah.
Hey, thanks again for that. It was really good. Based on your research, I understand it's a contentious topic, so consensus might be hard to sort of nail down, but based on your research, is there any... What's the Japanese position on the justification of the bombing?
It took some time for the bombings to sink in at a high level. I think the Japanese were more concerned about the treachery of the Soviets invading Manchuria while they were talking to Soviet politicians or their foreign affairs people to try and talk about stopping the war. And of course, the Japanese have continually celebrate is the wrong word, but the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki comes up every year, and it's little white cranes and all sorts of things. And my personal view, and I must say that it is my personal view, and it's probably somewhat controversial, is that given the situation as it was at the time, that the atomic bombing was quite justified.
When you look at the number of forces involved in Operation Olympic and Operation Coronet, how many armies did they have? You know, at least 6 or 7. When you think of the numbers involved in that, if they went ahead with the invasion and then looked at the casualty figures, then even on a numerical basis, I think you could say that it would be justified, regardless of one side or the other, just from the Allied side.
I mean, we look at the invasion of Iwo Jima and the invasion of Okinawa, and you look at the number of American casualties that resulted from the fact that the Japanese fought to the death and very, very few of them surrendered. If it had been necessary to invade Japan, I think that the casualty figures would have been huge.
Yeah.
And equally, the casualty figures for the Japanese military and the Japanese civilians who were being organised to fight any invasion would have been horrendous. And the people who died, sadly, in the bombings of Hiroshima and Japan and Nagasaki possibly died for a cause.
Mm. Any final sort of questions or comment? Tony?
I was in cables. We landed at Iwakuni's name airport, which is still based with American squadrons here at the moment. What I saw as we're landing was that Kure Harbour was littered in 1954 with wrecks everywhere, so you could say that was a tribute to precision bombing.
Oh, that was
that, because they left Hiroshima and it was a bomb like it was left to as one of the targets. You always kill.
I went to Kure in the early 1960s and they cleared the boats up by then, but yeah.
All right, well, look, thanks once again, Dennis. Absolutely fantastic presentation. I really appreciate the effort that you've gone to. And can you join me again in thanking Dennis?